everyone, and welcome back to a new season of the Buddhist Center podcast. I'm your host, Chandra Dasa, and it's very nice to be back after a little break for the summer. We're recording this, actually, only after a couple of weeks' break at the end of June. Hope you've had a great summer, or if you're in the Southern Hemisphere, a great winter. That was the voice for a mystery guest. He'll be with us in a second.
Okay.
Hushed till you're introduced, young man. Yes, very lovely to be here again. As ever, the world is now full of podcasts. You can't walk down the street without bumping into a podcast, if that metaphor works for you. So look, if you enjoy this, if you enjoy what you hear here, all the stories, all the voices, all the tales of practice, please let someone else know. Tell your friends. You can just tell them in person, hey, you should listen to this podcast. You can write to them. But of course, you can leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or Stitcher or any of the places that you get podcasts. You know where that is because you're listening to this.
On it.
Excellent. I'm really happy to begin this new season with someone who's been absent from the podcast for a couple of years. We used to do a series with him, an occasional series called Kamala Shila's Quarterly. And we used to record Kamala Shila's Quarterly in the kitchen of his flat or apartment in West Hampstead in London. But we're now in a completely different world in many different ways, which is going to be one of the themes of our conversation. So we're going to welcome Kamala Shila now to the podcast in his back garden in the very beautiful county of Suffolk in England. But he'll tell us more about that in a little minute. Welcome, Kamala Shila.
Well, it's very nice to be interviewed, actually. I used to enjoy those things that we did in London.
Late-night conversations. I remember the immersion heater or the boiler or something in your kitchen that would go off every so often during the conversation.
Probably,
in the edit, we'd be listening and we'd go, oh, there goes the boiler. And sometimes the train would go past outside the window.
Constant trains, yeah.
So this is a very different world, and we're in a very different world in many senses, post-pandemic. Our last conversation was not that long before the pandemic began. Maybe 6 months or so.
Mm.
Maybe you could just give us a bit of a sense of, well, where are we? Where are we in the garden of England with horses neighing in the distance and blackbirds and barn swallows and all the rest?
Well, it wasn't very long after we talked that we had to leave our flat. And so we took the first gap in the pandemic to look around for somewhere to live. And we found this place in Suffolk. We're not far from Lowestoft. In fact, we're a short drive from the beach. It's very isolated, surrounded by fields, and you might even hear the sound of a horse, although they seem to have stopped doing that now, don't they?
Oh, they'll come back.
They were whinnying and neighing just now. We've got a lovely large garden. We're sitting in the middle of the rather overgrown lawn, which is great, with lots of wildflowers and birds. Delightful shade, which is quite necessary on a sunny day like this.
A sunny English summer's day. We'll probably include a photograph or two with this, but at one end of this rather long, almost wild meadow, there's a beautiful sculpture of the Buddha sitting under the tree, already dissipating into the hedge, which I rather like. It's growing up very healthily, covered in buttercups and clover and lots of grasses. There's some hedgerow around. We've got some willow trees, poppies. A riot of English garden. This is the best of England, I think, this kind of thing.
Pretty good.
It's pretty good. Good,
yeah.
And the area, you didn't say this, but you're living in the grounds of Summer Leighton Hall.
That's correct, yeah.
Which is all very Downton Abbey, if you're listening to this online.
Yeah,
if you want an idea
of
this, it's basically Downton Abbey. He lives in the grounds in a cottage, one of many, in the grounds of the local seat of the baronetcy. Is that correct?
It is a baronetcy, yeah.
Summer Leighton, who owns all the land around here and seems many of the houses. So it's an extraordinary place to come, and it seems a fitting place to start.
I've no idea how we got here, really. It was
a complete stroke of luck. You just appeared.
Yeah, I know.
You just manifested.
Yeah.
So those of you who don't know Kamala Shila from previous podcasts,
Number
one, go back and listen to the old episodes. They're really awesome. Number two, Kamala Shila, amongst many things, is a very well-known and much-loved meditation teacher in our community, the Truratna Buddhist community. He's also a good friend to many people and has been a kind of stalwart of our order for how many decades, do you want to say?
Oh, God. I was ordained in 1974. Please do the maths.
I was born in 1971, folks. So he's been doing this for a long time. And
I'm 73 now, and I was ordained when I was 24.
Yeah. So, and you were also one of the first order members I met from outside of the city I lived. I remember coming to a weekend meditation workshop.
Oh, really?
very near the start of when I got involved with Buddhism, in a women's community in Glasgow.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
That's right.
Yeah,
and
Vera
you,
Davey was there.
Vera Davey, and you saluted the shrine, and I put my hand up and said, what does that mean? And you were extremely patient. You were like,
shut up.
Well, you didn't. You might have thought that, but you didn't say it. You sort of explained what the words meant, or sort of connoted, I suppose. Mm. Around saluting the shrine, which I found very helpful.
Cool.
So thank you for that, 30-odd years later. In fact, it is 30 years later. I think we've almost known each other for 30 years. Wow. Next year, next May, will be 30 years. So I guess there's quite a lot to catch up on over 3 years since
Just the three.
Just the three. We're not going to recap our whole 30 years. The first thing is the world has been turned upside down, hasn't it, in the last 2 years?
We've had the pandemic. We've had the pandemic and all that that's involved pretty globally, isn't it?
Yeah. And apart from moving house to Downton Abbey, what have you been up to during the pandemic?
Well, when we talked last, I just discovered the potential of doing online retreats and teaching. When the pandemic started, it was the only way that you could do it, and it became the only way that anyone could do it. For at least a year, I was doing these week-long retreats, and I found that a very good medium for clarifying my own ideas and interacting with order members. They were all order retreats, and I do retreats on various aspects of Dharma practice. I really enjoyed the medium, actually. I think it has a lot to do with the fact that people are practicing at home. There's a little bit of an adjustment to make there. But once you've made it, it's the most relaxing place to practice. You're not on your best behaviour in any sense at all. And that's the best place to be when you're talking about quite subtle things, how you're responding, looking deeply into your experience and so on. And that, I think that it's really enabled by practicing at home. If people can get over the problem of the fact they're just looking into their computers in their front room or in their kitchen or something like that. Well, if you get over that and can connect with the people on the other side, then it works really well. And I was working with order members, and of course I know most of them personally, and so it was easier to make a personal connection. So it was just, oh, hello, haven't seen you for a while, but I know you very well. So I think that makes a huge difference.
Well, we're going to keep asking you to do stuff online for no order members. I'm just telling you that.
I'd be very happy to if there was a way to do it. Yeah.
But it strikes me that I remember the conversation quite well before the pandemic, and it's interesting to pick it up again now. And at both ends of that little spectrum of time, there were no restrictions, so people were in a way choosing to engage in that space when it wasn't necessary.
Sure.
And I think one of the things we touched on was, well, there's a lot of resistance to it. Most of that centres around not being in person, quote unquote, which is an interesting concept, that you're not really with people, even though they're there on computers, but you're not physically
embodied with them.
Yeah.
And it raises all sorts of questions about what it means to be really with another person, doesn't it?
Or to have a relationship, a sense of relationship.
Yes.
People have relationships with objects all
the
time.
What about these guys who are listening to this? What kind of relationship do they have with us?
Are you real?
Yeah, exactly.
Am I real?
It's a good question.
Oh, goodness. What we talked about last time was, we thought from our experience of a couple of years of engaging with this kind of context, that it really was possible to have a meaningful sense of both connection and wider community, and then to go deep over time to build up some of the same habits, positive habits, that some of the same almost like mental muscles kicked in. If you're used to having a sustained practice, if you kept up a sustained practice with other people on, well, at that point it was probably Skype, not Zoom, but you know, something would happen that we both recognized. I guess the whole world has kind of been thrown into that space where they've really had to test that proposition. And so your time working with order members and going deep, what's the range of that? Is it like short retreats? Is it long retreats?
Well, I did the week-long ones, but I've done 2 3-month ones now over the winter. So I've done long ones as well.
So what's involved in a 3-month online retreat? Are you just at your computer the whole time? Are you like...
Well, I think most of us are at our computer every day anyway, aren't we? No, people could sign up for the whole thing or sign up for just 3 weeks. I had a minimum, so that would be some depth of engagement. But the great majority of people, in the end, they do things like say, I'll come for the 3 weeks and see how I get on. And then they just stay for the whole thing. I think there were about 70 of us did it, you know, over that whole period, including the 3 weekers and the 4 weekers. So we just had a meditation program, and I'd do a bit of teaching in the morning. I would just do bits of teaching wherever it felt appropriate, because over a 3-month period, it's really very relaxed, and you'd really get to know what's happening with people individually. And so it was possible to have quite an intimate teaching situation. And it was great, because there were some people who were right up there in the, I think Rupa Chit is up in the Outer Hebrides somewhere, isn't it?
That's right, you know, don't you? Yeah, a little bit.
You know, she was there, and there were people from Australia, New Zealand, it's worldwide. So it was very varied. The benefits would have been different for different people. Some people really treated it like a full-on retreat. In fact, they did solitary practice. Others moved in with a friend and they did it together. Other people were still working, going out, I think, Rupachitta, again, just teaching, doesn't she? She was going out teaching and getting into all sorts of stuff. So it could be different things for different people. But for everybody, there was the daily practice and the evening. We usually did some kind of ritual and some kind of meditation practice. For even someone who was living an ordinary working life with lots of distractions and things blowing up in their faces, the regular practice was a grounding influence and somewhere where they could still develop their practice in everyday life. And I think that's what a lot of people could really do with.
Mm. Well, I find it really encouraging to know that there are just people getting on with that sort of practice every day in a not particularly dramatic way. They're not going off to the mountains for 3 months, which is its own thing and is fantastic if you can do it, but very few people can do that.
Most people aren't doing that. Yeah, right.
So there's something really encouraging about it. I've noticed we do these 3 or 4 times a year. We have these week-long home retreats. And again, you get, so far this will be quite familiar to people listening, pandemic time, practice online, internationality, people from all
over
the world.
That's right, you're doing it now, aren't you?
We've been doing it for years, that's right. People practicing from all over the world, parents, people working, all the rest of it. One thing I've noticed is we get letters from people who do the retreats that we put on after they're finished, which I found very interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
Because we've got, you know, a dedicated page for the whole retreat with all the sessions embedded and all the materials.
I do that as well. Yeah.
That's right. And they have a week off and it doesn't suit the week when we're doing the retreat, but they actually quite faithfully sit at home and do the retreat, which I've been super impressed by.
Like,
I think if you'd posed it to people that that would happen, they'd have said, people aren't going to do that in any kind
of
numbers.
That's right,
But they really do.
They really do, don't they? It's an accepted thing. I record everything and video everything as well. And I've got someone helping me who puts all the videos up on the resource page, you know, just after it's happened. So people who had to go out that day can get that day's practice or teaching that very day.
All of that, in a way, might be quite familiar to listeners. They've been listening to us banging on about online practice for the last couple of years because everyone's had to.
Yeah.
And there is a bit of fatigue, I think, just now, where a lot of people don't want to spend time. Although I think there is now a kind of well-established basis of practice online. I think the thing I'm quite interested in with you, Kamal Sheila, is we were talking the other day about the kind of other strains in your practice and your sort of interest around meditation that have been developing through this time that aren't primarily to do with the online space or the technology and all of the rest of it. And particularly around sadhana. You were talking the other day to me about sadhana and your kind of emerging theory of sadhana. Look at your face. You're like, what?
What?
Don't be, what?
Did I say that?
You did, yes.
Well, nearly all my retreats are actually sadhana retreats. Yeah. Because they're for order members.
Do you want to give people a little preview of what sadhana means if you don't know?
So exactly, people are going to think, well, what is that? Well, it's actually a word that's just appeared in the English dictionary I discovered this week. If you look up sadhana in the Oxford English Dictionary, it says something like the build-up of one's life's work, particularly in the fields of religion and music, apparently. It must come in from the Indian influence on our culture. It comes from a Sanskrit word, sadhana, which means something like that. It's like a life of practice type of work. You know, if you're a composer or a religious practitioner, you build something up, and that build-up of all the different practices you do and all the different skills you develop in dumb practice, that is considered to be your sadhana. Now, that's a very general use of the word, but it's quite a useful use of the word. What we usually mean by sadhana in Triratna Buddhist order is a particular visualization practice where you visualize a figure like the Buddha, Shakyamuni, or might be Padmasambhava or Tara, and that is considered to be your chosen deity or your chosen practice. So you do meditation practices around that figure, and there are particular special practices that you can do, usually visualization of the Buddha, and there's a sense that you can really connect with them on some level or other. You know, so it's a bit like a magical Buddhist practice.
Well, that's one of the things we're going to get into, the magic of it.
Yeah.
I suppose, again, I really love that broad definition, particularly the connection with the arts and music. And in a way, a lot of people might recognise that general concept in their own life. There's something that coheres through a long life of certain kind of education or interest.
Yeah, that puts it very well, yeah.
Yeah, again, it's a very encouraging definition. If you're looking up sadhana, it's S-A-D-H-A-N-A. Look it up in the dictionary, see what you find. I suppose specifically with the meditation practice, a lot of people who have heard of the practice or done the practice will be familiar with the idea of sort of calling down qualities associated with various figures, and that idea that what you turn your mind to, that's what you become over time. So you're cultivating a relationship that feels transformative. It's not abstract. Mm. You're not really primarily concerned with what's real and what's not real about it. Something's working and it's happening. This evocation of it as magic, I was really intrigued by the other day when we were talking. Since I was a kid, I've loved the idea of magic and dragons and all that stuff. So we're not talking Game of Thrones, but what is the magic that you're thinking of? Why is magic the word you go to?
Well, I think it's because you have no real idea why it works. It just works, even though the rational explanations are a bit thin. One rational explanation is all Buddhist practice comes from the Buddha. And so the figure of the Buddha somehow contains for you a lot of associations that you can relate to very strongly. And so there's a strong connection with that figure. And so for you, that figure can catalyze or channel Dharma teachings. But there's clearly an element of magic there. And the Indo-Tibetan Vajrayana tradition has all kinds of little details in the way you visualize these figures that definitely make it magical. So, for example, they use the sort of channels in the body. So you have these different chakras in the body, and that's visualized on the figure of the Buddha. On the Buddha's forehead, at their heart, at their throat, you have these points where light comes down to your own chakras in your own body. And there's a kind of exchange that happens with your visualization of that figure. Now, that is definitely very non-rational. You're not trying to understand something, you're just relaxing into your trust of their teaching and just really taking that in and being transformed by it.
But it is still mediated by human consciousness, isn't it? Although you're using the metaphor of externality, there's something that you're looking at, the whole thing is also contained within the construct of human consciousness, at least as we experience it, or some sort of anthropocentric way of doing consciousness. The reason I mention that is I was reading this morning an essay about an aspect of quantum theory that I didn't know. People often know that thing about the non-location of different entangled particles affecting each other.
Uh-huh.
You know, spooky action at a distance thing that Einstein talks about. And this is a new area that people are going into more, which is almost drilling down into that and seeing that context is almost everything in what they understand of quantum mechanics. And there's something magic about all that stuff too, because you think, well, something's happening. It's detectable, it means something, and you've absolutely no idea.
It can't be explained.
It can't be explained.
Yeah. Not adequately, in a way. You can never go, of course.
Whether they're quantum mechanical forces or the kind of open-hearted belief force of someone doing a sadhana practice. Do you think that's something that applies in people's lives generally? Is something that goes on in the background for people in everyday life, and their sadhana practice focuses attention on it and gives you a training on how to touch?
I suppose if you've taken in some ideas but you haven't really completely taken it on board, and I'm speaking quite generally, you go away and you live your life and your thoughts come and go, and after a while you accept it on a deeper level, you've fully accepted it and it's part of your life, and that sort of thing can happen with ordinary life. But in terms of the Dharma, you might take in all the ideas around impermanence, all the ideas around deep transformation. But actually, on the surface, there can be quite a degree of acceptance of it, but no real experience. And I think that real experience, it isn't something rational, it's something you have to open yourself to. That can take place over a long period of time in your life. But also, the way I think of sadhana, it is more like you already know the truth, but there's a large part of you that hasn't caught up with that. The way the sadhana practice works can spark that and give a sort of inner space for that.
Given your definition at the start about a body of work, as it were, building up over time, that's also a description of what happens with the self. You build up a body of work that is you over time. It's not as inflexible as you might think it is, but it feels pretty settled, and you've got a sense of continuity and sometimes a sense of change in that, but it seems that the dynamics of this are at least parallel somewhere, in that you're making a very particular effort and you're not really concerned with the status existentially of what's happening, you're concerned with the effect. You must change your life. Is it having an effect that is skillful, positive?
Yes.
And I'm just wondering about, is there a parallel and dynamic with seeing sadhana as the more consciously directed building up of... Well, there is effort involved, isn't there? You're turning towards a particular constellation of...
Well, that would definitely come into it, of course, yeah. Yeah, although a lot of the work's coming out of the fact that you're going to the area of non-self. There is no real actual self. It's an illusory construct that we create, this building up of a self, even though we do it. And it's important to us. At the same time, your understanding is growing of the reality of that. Again, it's something that can't really be described. The form of the sadhana with the lights and the, let's call it the visionary aspect of it, that gives you a framework to play with where it's okay for it to be non-rational.
And the fact that it's colour and sound and all that helps.
So you have to accept the framework first. And I think that's a barrier for quite a lot of people because it just seems religious. It's weird. There's elements to it which you might react to. And if you do that, well, you can't really do it. You have to somehow accept the framework, at least in some kind of provisional way, and not treat it too seriously. If people treat it too seriously, the reality of it becomes too hard. Mm. It needs to have a soft, playful aspect to it. Mm. It's like the nature of your own mind. It's something quite evanescent and ungraspable.
I was just thinking about people listening to this and hearing things like non-self or Buddhist ideas. It's already all
get
there.
Used to
if,
it.
If you just see it. There's also the way you described that there, that soft playfulness where you're really essentially just trying to be open to something and letting it work on you without trying to fix it with some kind of defining framework that makes you feel safe. You
that's
know?
Right.
It's almost like a just different move you have to make. And presumably people do that for a reason. They have to see something, something that impels them to make that move.
Do it because they have a spiritual commitment, because they go for refuge and they want to become awakened. That's why they do it. They see that this is a effective way. It's not the only way, of course, but it's quite an effective way and has a long tradition in Buddhism. What is really striking me at the moment is the whole thing is an exploration of what is our spiritual ideal, to use those words? What is it that we're drawn by in our practice? And this is something we probably could think about, we probably could articulate it, but we probably wouldn't be able to articulate it in a very satisfactory way because it's something a bit mysterious. We cannot know what it is because we haven't realised it. So you have awakening as an ideal, as a concept, that we do not realise, but at the same time, we're deeply attracted to it. What is going on there? So I think sadhana practice, and all Buddhist practice really, because there isn't really a complete difference, sadhana practice really focuses on this thing. What is the object of refuge? And it personifies it. So you might personify it as Shakyamuni Buddha. But, you know, Shakyamuni Buddha isn't something we understand. Shakyamuni Buddha might be an object that we feel even veneration and respect for. But why is that? Why would you? It's because there's something mysterious that we intuit. So those things are very mysterious, but they're very important to us. We don't think about them very much. So, for example, in the retreat I'm just about to do, we will be focusing on this aspect of our experience. It's a good opportunity to do that. We don't often take those opportunities because there's too many other things to be getting on with.
It's interesting to listen to you talk about mystery. For some reason, what came to mind was there's a particular talk by Sangharakshita, I can't remember which one, where he talks about the danger of mystery mongering. And it's partly his accent when he says it.
Mystery mongering.
Mystery mongering.
Bad impressions.
Bad impressions, yeah. People can do much better impersonations of Sangharakshita. But anyway, he talks about mystery mongering. And that's the shadow side, I suppose, of the fact that, as you say, people are just attracted to mystery. And something I read, I think it was this morning again, I should look up the reference, but somebody said the work of an artist is not to understand the mystery, it's to help deepen the sense of mystery in a way that is meaningful and transformative for people. Something of that comes across in the way you're talking about the object of refuge or the thing you are giving your attention to without understanding what it all is.
Yeah, that's deepening that sense of mystery. But the mystery, it has to have some sort of meaning for you. If one's just attracted to mystery because it's weird and mysterious, I think that's just a waste of time.
Well, that's the mystery mongering thing, isn't it? Yeah. You can cater to that if you like, but it's not very nourishing.
I mean, it's self-indulgent.
Esotericism. All that exotic stuff.
But if you are of that temperament, actually, there may be something going on, which is wonderful, which needs to be explored. It just means the person needs to look at themselves a bit more than the mystery somehow. I think that's what it's about. So it's like the image that we have. It's externalised, it's personified, it's out there. But the real image is in the mind, and it can't be accessed directly. Mysterious thing.
You've also got this long story body of practice yourself around
Saturn. Yeah, I learn from it as well.
Of being open.
Yeah.
How has that changed through the years? And has it changed particularly in the pandemic, or has that been more...
Oh, God. Well, I mean, sometimes it just gets more difficult. You know, it's more embarrassing, because learning is a process of realising that you're wrong most of the time. You just keep realising, oh, I never had that right. Oh, yes, they never understood what I said then, et cetera, et cetera. So that's my experience anyway. Mm. And I'm sure it's not just my experience. There's a kind of experience of undoing of your assumptions. What's been great for me, the opportunity to do these so many retreats, and to do so many retreats at my own, I'm in charge of it, as it were, because I just arrange them and do them. Whereas before, I always had to wait for a retreat centre to say, yes, you can do a retreat next September. Now I can just do them whenever I like. It's a huge difference for me. So I can do something every couple of months or every few weeks. That seems to me worth doing. So I've learned tremendously through being able to teach in that way, to having a bit of a platform, really.
And the new rhythms of that, and then the fact that people come and join you in that rhythm and the collective element. Yeah. That's presumably something that does happen in bursts when you go to traditional retreat centres and do retreats, but
it's usually a bit clunky. I mean, I don't know if it's like this in all traditions, but for us in Tree Ratton, I think it's a bit clunky because retreat centre makes their programme and they say, okay, would you like to do a retreat in September 2023? And you're going to tell us what you're going to do, what topic you're going to choose. And you say, oh, let's do something on the bodhicitta. And then 2 years later, or 18 months later, or a year later, you have to turn up with your material. Of course we can do it. The process isn't so immediately about what's on your mind. One of the great advantages for me of this way of doing retreats, I know it's got loads of disadvantages, one of the great advantages is I can really come from my current experience. It's a huge change. It's never been like this before.
It's an interesting point. As the reality of online practice settles into part of people's expectation, certainly as a team we've come under pressure to plan further ahead because there's no more competition for events and all that stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And it makes a certain kind of natural sense, but there was something about the spontaneity of just being able to respond to what seemed to be needed during the pandemic that was energising in a way, because currents go through communities like anything else. And I remember when George Floyd happened, suddenly there was a lot of attention on that, or occasionally climate stuff, or just currents of practice that were going on. You could capture the moment a bit at relatively short notice and just invite people in. And of course, that doesn't necessarily make money or attract big audiences.
It's not just the pandemic, it's the global culture that enables that now.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think what the effect of the pandemic is people being much more aware of that, of the universality of that dynamic, really.
Well, the internet having, almost for the first time, a really clearly defined function that was communal.
Yes, yeah.
Instead of going and looking into a screen and seeing other people doing things on Facebook or Instagram or whatever, it's like you can go and take part in stuff with people.
Yes,
and that being normalised as a thing to do with your time.
Yeah.
And it's now, of course, the world's reopening everywhere and the competition is now back with in-person communal events where you can
Great, but the online thing hasn't gone away. Everyone knows that now, that they can go and do a Zoom with somebody they previously never considered that they could have any connection with at all.
Or had to travel half the country to get
that's
to.
Right.
That's right, yeah. And it was expensive and all the rest of it.
Yes. Mm. That isn't going to go away, I don't think.
So does the change in circumstances affect the magic of what you can now do much now that the world's reopening? Do you think there'll be another shift in the shape of all this, or do you think there's a kind of settled community of people who are just going to keep on that rhythm with you?
Well, I don't really know. I mean, I'm a very particular person and there are very particular people who are interested in what I do. I think it is quite a small circle, really. I don't know how many of the younger order members even that have much awareness of what I do. So, you know, I'm just working with the people that I know. That may not last very long. You know, I'm not going to last that much longer. I'm just working with that. I mean, people are now talking about there being a very strong sense of a community in my retreats. When I first heard that, I thought, oh, no, I don't want that. Because it just sounded like a group thing, you know, like my little group. And I didn't really like the sound of that. But on the other hand, you have to like it. I mean, it's a really good thing that they feel that. In a way, I didn't want it to get too enclosed and too...
Too identified with you.
Yeah, that's right. I could feel myself resisting that before I saw the positive side of that. So that made me think that I must try to do some new things, not different places where I do the online things, but more like different kinds of dharma that I would teach.
Mm.
You know, I think I need to extend my range a bit or explore some new things, and I think I'm starting to do that. So I think that's a result of realising that the pandemic's over and that people were behaving differently and their relationship to this style of teaching is changing. Personally, I'm finding that the same number of people are signing up, but it does tend to be the same people with a kind of sprinkling of newer people. So I'm fairly optimistic that it is going to continue.
Now, the other thing that we regularly talked about in Camel Shillers Quarterly is technology and how that affects culture. And I suppose that meeting point between the Dharma, Buddhist culture, and world culture, the stuff we take part in every day. And we were both interested in the capacity for technology, not just the internet. Obviously, the internet kind of runs through things like a river, but technology, devices, all of that stuff, which again, for many people, might seem slightly antithetical to Buddhism. They might think, oh, it's all distraction, phones and iPads.
It's all just machines. We're not machines, are we?
We're not machines, exactly. Yeah. And yet there is something quite exciting about thinking about how these kind of tools can actually augment what we do. Is it just superficially exciting?
I think it is, yeah.
Really?
I mean, we have trains, we have cars, we have means of transport. All these things have made huge changes to human conditions and to the Dharma. But fundamentally, it's all the same stuff. And it's when we didn't have those things. If you go back to at least the records of practice in old Tibet, where things are very, very basic technology, it's just an exchange between people with more and less realization. It's exciting that you can reach people. It's exciting that they have much, much more control over what they can take in from other people. Those things are for sure exciting, but it is still a lesser, you know, it's not the main thing.
Okay, I mean, that's sort of true. I suppose the one aspect that might not be quite the same as the Tibetan monastery is the democratization of access to stuff like that. So in the Tibetan monastery, only one person is probably going to put together any texts.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah,
very few people are ever going to actually see them.
Yeah.
I've watched you at your desk with your amazing setup of devices and screens.
Right.
And I suppose what strikes me about that is the devices and screens and stuff are interesting, but secondary, maybe going back again to the idea of sadhana as a sustained body of attention and body of work, is you're actually using that stuff to try and shape your own discourse about the Dharma, your teaching, you're engaging with some of the stuff we host online. Sangharaksh does lectures and seminars. There is something about having access to all of that in the right hands or with the right mind that is new in a way, isn't there? Like, very few people would get to saddle up and ride to the Library at Alexandria and partake of everything.
I was just trying to imagine just now when you were talking, doing all that with the old technology. And I can remember right back before we even had those green screen Amstrad computers, and I had a ZX Spectrum. I can remember before that we'd have things like filofaxes. But I can still imagine having 8 books open on a table.
Sure.
And having lots of notebooks and having lots of systems with tabs, and a bit like as technical as a computer, because you'd get geeky with what you had.
Yeah.
So I can still imagine that. You wouldn't know what you were missing, but you'd still be trying to do it. You would own a lot more books.
It would probably take more of your time in the sense that it would be very difficult to do anything else around that because the effort required to collate all that material and keep it available. It does go a bit faster with some aspects of technology, at least.
Be less distracted.
Less distracted.
Yeah, you wouldn't have Facebook on your computer at the same time.
I'm sure
you wouldn't have this, and this happening at the same time. You wouldn't have the opportunity to catch up with the news and all those things, playing music at the same time. You wouldn't be doing that.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that a bit of a digitally regressive argument where it's like suddenly like everyone born into that technology natively is just doomed to be more distracted than us? Isn't there a way that human consciousness is going to work a bit differently? People will study differently, do depth differently, multitask in different ways. That
you have to be disciplined, really disciplined, to make modern technology work. And I guess we're all learning that the hard way very often.
But I wonder if the way you and I are learning it, because we remember when ZX Spectrum's tape loading computers came out.
Yes.
I was with my nieces this trip, and they're 5 years old. And they've got so much facility with technology that I remember being intimidated by it like a decade ago. They're just swiping away. And there's a depth of expectation that they have about the way they receive information.
Yeah.
And it seems to me it's too early to call whether that is per se more distracted because it's device-based or whether
I don't think it is per se more distracted. All I was referring to was just the fact that the way our technology is set up, we have just so many possibilities.
Yeah.
And that itself is somehow distracting. I just mean the fact that all these things are simultaneously possible. Mm. So you really have to sort out in your own mind what not to do and where not to go.
So I guess to round this off, what's exciting you now? Yeah. What's exciting you about life, practice, culture?
What's exciting? Yeah,
what's emerging for you? You've been doing a lot of writing, a lot of thinking.
Mm. I think I'm getting a much clearer understanding of the areas that I'm teaching in around order practices, Buddhist practice, a lot more clarity. I find that exciting. But I still very much feel that I really need to do a solitary retreat. I haven't really stopped for this entire period, and I've realised this year that there's a really strong need to do that. So I've planned doing 3 months retreats for the order members, but I haven't done a solitary myself. I need to do that. So I'm looking forward to that kind of simplicity. Excitement about the future and what can come out of what I'm doing. It feels like quite early days. You know, we've moved to this new area during the pandemic, so we've hardly had any opportunity to make any connections locally. I think for me, there's another year of just settling in, really, to things. And there's always been a question mark about whether this way of working, I can sustain it. Well, I think I can. I think it's going to work financially. You know, I'm going to be able to continue without trying to think of what I'm going to do to earn money. This is supporting me, so that's good.
Yeah, that's great.
I would like to have a more varied kind of output. I've been thinking of starting doing meditation classes locally. So, as you can tell, I'm still exploring, really.
Yeah.
It's a bit of a new wicket, is that the right word?
A new wicket? Yeah,
yes.
You're in a new wicket.
Still working out what kind of things I should be doing in these circumstances.
Hey, I just had an idea. I was just sort of listening to your soft voice and the sounds of the garden. Particularly the bird song and just the wind and the wind in the willows over there. And
let's try and see if we can tune into the sounds of this space we're in now. It's going to include the space that you're in, the listener. So you might have all kinds of sounds around you. But there's also the sound, once you get really still, of your own body. And all the very subtle sounds of the breath, and even other sounds. You just stop and listen. So, we never got a whinny, we never got a neigh from the horses.
Got lots of other nice sounds. Yes, not a whinny, not a neigh, but the wind and birdsong.
Whatever that is,
blackbirds and barn swallows I can see flitting around. You know, it'd be good to do more podcasts where there's just the sound. I've been following one where a guy goes walking around Japan on his holidays from work. And he just records sounds, urban sounds, country sounds.
They're all good, aren't they?
Beautiful ones to listen to.
Yeah, I agree.
So, hey, thank you for letting us sit in your garden with you.
Well, it's been nice talking to you and talking to everybody here, and I wish you all well.
Yeah, maybe we'll do this quarterly again.
I'm always very happy to talk to you and just come and
come and see you.
We can just do it online.
We can do it online, it's true, but there is something nice about being here embodied and meeting people to talk in their gardens. So hey, I hope you've enjoyed hearing Kamala Sheila's reflections on the magic of sadhana and the encouragement of taking seriously but not too seriously a body of transformative work through a life. We'll be back soon with another episode in season 2 of this podcast. 430 odd episodes in. I'm not sure how many seasons we can divide that into. But hope you're well and safe and happy wherever you are. And we'll see you again online soon. Bye for now.